The liver is one of our least appreciated organs, and yet it has amazing superpowers like the ability to regenerate. This is the People's Pharmacy with Terry and Joe Graydon.
Most people are unaware of the liver's essential role in maintaining good health. In addition to its digestive role, the liver is crucial for detoxifying many chemicals and pharmaceuticals.
Today, we're talking with two liver experts. They'll tell us about the dangers of too much acetaminophen, an ingredient in hundreds of OTC medications.
We'll also find out why some natural products might also cause problems.
Coming up on the People's Pharmacy, how to love your liver and protect its superpowers.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines, there's both good news and bad news about COVID. The good news is that infections are down to low levels. Hospitalizations are low and slowly decreasing. That's all good. But there's also a new variant that's gaining prominence. Technically known as strain BA.3.2, it has 70-some mutations that differentiate it from the current dominant strain, JN1. Because it was first identified more than a year ago and then seemingly went underground until recently, researchers have nicknamed it Cicada. The large number of changes in its spike protein suggests that current vaccines may not work as well to thwart it. The CDC reports that it has been detected in 25 states, but it's not yet causing a lot of COVID illnesses. Vaccine experts will be considering whether it should be included in the next version of the COVID vaccine.
Older people are not immune from the negative effects of consuming ultra-processed foods. A study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition followed nearly 5,000 middle-aged and older adults for about 6 years. At the beginning of the study, they filled out detailed dietary questionnaires. In addition, they took cognitive tests every 2 years. The scientists report that for every additional daily serving of ultra-processed meats, like pepperoni or bacon, the chance that cognitive scores would slip increased by 17%. Ultra-processed beverages, such as soft drinks, also increase the likelihood of cognitive decline. Oddly, however, other ultra-processed food categories, such as ready-to-eat meals or savory snacks, were not associated with the risk for cognitive impairment.
Most nutrition experts would frown at the idea that fat could help people manage their weight. But a study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that a long-term increase in olive oil consumption was associated with weight loss. Other fats, such as margarine or butter, were linked to weight gain. These data were derived from more than 120,000 middle-aged health professionals who participated in the Nurses' Health Study and the Health Professionals Follow-Up Study. The authors conclude that their findings reinforce the benefits of olive oil, even for people outside the Mediterranean region.
Food preservatives are found in most processed foods consumed around the world. Scientists have wondered if these compounds might have health consequences. An analysis of data from a large, long-running study conducted in France has found a connection between certain preservatives and an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. The average follow-up time on more than 100,000 participants was just over 8 years. People consuming high levels of potassium sorbate, sodium nitrite, and sodium erythrobate were at higher risk for type 2 diabetes. At least 10% of the French population consumes foods containing these preservatives. According to the authors, these findings support recommendations to favor fresh and minimally processed foods without superfluous additives.
Tramadol has become one of the most commonly prescribed pain medicines in the United States. It's a dual-action drug with some opioid-like qualities, along with some antidepressant activity. That's because it affects neurotransmitters like serotonin and norepinephrine. When tramadol was introduced as Ultram, the manufacturer suggested that this pain reliever would be better than opioids. Danish researchers recently conducted a meta-analysis and systematic review of 19 randomized placebo-controlled clinical trials involving over 6,000 participants. Their conclusion? Tramadol may have a slight effect on reducing chronic pain levels while likely increasing the risk of both serious and non-serious adverse events. The potential harms associated with tramadol use for pain management likely outweigh its limited benefits. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week. Welcome to the People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Graydon.
And I'm Joe Graydon. Do you know where your liver is located? How about its function? Why is the liver one of the most underappreciated organs in your body?
Most of us rarely think about our livers. Unless something goes wrong, how can you assess the health of your liver? What symptoms should you be alert for? More importantly, what can you do to keep your liver healthy?
To get answers to these important questions, we're speaking today with Dr. Mina Bansal. She's professor of medicine specializing in liver diseases at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She's assistant chief of the Division of Liver Diseases and director of the MASH-NASH Center of Excellence at Mount Sinai.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Mina Bansal.
Thank you. It's great to be here. I'm looking forward to a great discussion.
Well, thank you, Dr. Bansal. You know, you have been quoted as saying the liver is underappreciated, but dependable, kind of with superhero-like powers. So please, what's the story on the liver's superpowers? What are they?
Well, you know, the liver is your first line of defense. Everything you eat, any medication you take, the food you eat, it has to go through the liver first before the rest of the organs see it. So I always joke with my colleagues who might favor other organs, and I say, your organ doesn't see it unless my organ wants you to. So the liver really, its role is to detoxify, it's to metabolize. So what I mean by that is, you know, the portal circulation, when you eat, most of the blood flow goes through the portal vein. And so that has to filter through the liver before it then moves onward to the heart and then gets pumped out to the rest of the organs. And so over time, you think about it from an evolution perspective, the liver had to be so resilient to deal with anything that we encountered in our environment. And this is a little bit why it has this regenerative capability. You must have heard about, you know, the liver can regenerate, and if you cut half of it out, it grows back. So this is all part of its superpower.
Well, I pretend I know nothing about anatomy for just a sec.
Okay.
And so I have a delicious pasta salad for lunch. All I know is I swallow it and then it disappears until whatever is left comes out the other end. What happens as those nutrients in that delicious pasta salad are absorbed out of the digestive tract and into the bloodstream? What happens?
So after you eat, obviously you're digesting a little bit by chewing, then the stomach has high pH, digest it, and then you're secreting enzymes that further help break down those things like proteins into amino acids, you know, the kind of simple sugars, etc. Then the portal circulation drains the gut, and the portal vein enters into the liver, and the blood kind of separates into something called sinusoids, which are little channels where hepatocytes are lining it, and they're basically extracting all the good stuff and then filtering through, metabolizing anything that should not be seen by the rest of the body. Bacteria, you know, other bacteria, there are Kupffer cells in the liver that kind of scavenge those up, so that the blood then on the other side of the sinusoids join up, enter into the hepatic vein, and then drain into your IVC and into your heart. And then it gets pumped out into the arterial circulation. So this is the venous circulation entering the blood, and then filtering, detoxification, rejoining in a cleaner way, and then off to the rest of the body.
And presumably when it goes off to the rest of the body, it's full of the nutrients from that pasta salad.
Right, that's been broken down, correct. The liver also stores a lot of nutrients for a rainy day.
Oh, tell us about that.
Yeah, so that's why, you know, when you have excess glucose, for example, it's stored as glycogen in the liver. So when you're in a period of fasting, then there are mechanisms to then release that glycogen from the liver to provide the nutrients that you need. So the liver also plays a very important storage role. And that's a little bit why you see fat in the liver, right? When you have excess weight, you have fat in the liver, what people used to call fatty liver disease. It's kind of storing and holding on to that fat. Excessive fat, I must say, you know, in many cases, but that is one of the purposes of the liver, to save us when we're in periods of starvation.
So very few of us are usually in periods of starvation nowadays.
Exactly.
You know, there might be times when people are fasting, and they would be calling on those stores. But as I understand it, fatty liver disease is quite a problem nowadays. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, you actually kind of hit on that. So we grew up as hunter-gatherers for much of our existence. And so the liver developed the ability to do exactly what we said, is just kind of keep us ready for a situation of starvation. But as we've evolved, some of those genetics, some of those human physiologic mechanisms are still there, but now we're not in a situation where we have starvation, like you said. Obviously, in some parts of the world you do, which is tragic. But for the many of the developed countries, we now have overnutrition, but a body that has evolved to hold on to that energy and save us kind of that fight or flight, that, you know, starvation situation to sustain us. And so many have postulated in the obesity world that part of the reason that we have an obesity epidemic is because of this exact thing. Evolutionarily, we're built to hold on in periods of starvation, but societally now we are exposed to overnutrition.
Well, Dr. Bonsall, let me tell you about my Uncle Gene. Uncle Gene was not overweight. He exercised regularly. He was an outdoors person. And he did not drink alcohol. He shunned it. But he developed what's called non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. And it was pretty serious. And then he said, I figured it out. It's sugar. And he shunned sugar the way he shunned alcohol. And he managed to do quite well for a very long period of time. What was happening to Uncle Gene?
So certainly fructose in the environment is taken up by the liver and is responsible for what we call de novo lipogenesis, or the creation of fat within the hepatocyte. And so we definitely tell patients to avoid any fructose-containing drinks. You know, when you think of that corn syrup, that those types of things are absolutely contributors to what was, I can go through the nomenclature change in a moment, but let's just, with your Uncle Gene, fatty liver disease. But there's also lean The name is now Masled and MASH. We can go into that in a second. But this lean, non-alcoholic fatty liver disease, as it was known, usually patients have some underlying insulin resistance. So even though they may be lean, they might have, say, a little bit of an apple shape versus a pear, maybe a little bit extra around the abdomen. It's that fat or increased waist circumference that's actually associated more with the deposition of fat in the liver. So someone could look pretty lean, but if they have insulin resistance and they have an increased waist circumference, that's associated with what we call visceral adiposity or fat in the organs.
So we are going to go through that nomenclature change in a little bit, but for right now, let's just acknowledge that having fat in your liver is a bad thing, not good for your health. How would somebody know that they had fat in their liver?
And how common is it?
So it's quite common. If you look across the United States, probably about 60 to 70% of patients have fat in their liver as defined. So what we call abnormal fat in the liver is 5%, right? So 5% is that threshold where there is increased fat deposition in the liver. And many people have that increased fat deposition in the liver, but it's when the fat stimulates an injury response or fibrosis that those patients can get into trouble. So many people will have fat or steatosis, but in most people, it's not stimulating the injury, the inflammation, the damage to the hepatocytes that then instigates a wound healing response in the liver. So just like we have any wound healing response, if you cut your hand, you're going to have a scar. If you keep cutting your hand, that scar will get bigger and bigger. Same thing in the liver. You have some injury and it's a normal wound healing response to injury. So it lays down some collagen to wall off that injury. If the injury goes away, the fibrosis will resorb, just like a scar will ultimately go away on your hand. But if the injury is persistent and keeps coming and coming and coming, there's no time for those reparative processes to happen. And you're in a constant state of wound healing, fibrosis, which ultimately accumulates, and you can develop cirrhosis.
You're listening to Dr. Mina Bansal, professor of medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is system chief of the Division of Liver Diseases and director of the MASH-NASH Center of Excellence at Mount Sinai.
After the break, we'll learn about liver cirrhosis.
How do changes in the liver affect your overall health?
You'll hear how to prevent liver problems and why drinking black coffee is good for your liver.
We'll also hear from another scientist about how medications may affect liver health.
Does the popular pain reliever acetaminophen really pose a risk?
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Terry Grayton.
And I'm Joe Grayton. We're talking about how to protect your liver and its superpowers.
We'll also find out about medications that may be harmful to the liver with Dr. Jawad Ahmad. Later, you'll learn how some herbs and supplements might put a strain on the liver.
But first, we continue our conversation with Dr. Mina Bansal. She is professor of medicine specializing in liver diseases at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is system chief of the Division of Liver Diseases and director of the MASH-NASH Center of Excellence at Mount Sinai.
Dr. Bansal, we have heard the term liver cirrhosis. What is that?
So cirrhosis is really at the one spectrum of fibrosis. So when you have liver injury and you lay down scar, that is fibrosis. And we stage fibrosis on a scale of 0 to 4. So 0 fibrosis, stage 1, now you're accumulating fibrosis, stage 2, more fibrosis, stage 3, more fibrosis. Ultimately, stage 4 equals cirrhosis. So the increased accumulation of fibrosis over time gets you to cirrhosis, which is when you actually have these nodule formations. So the scar completely encapsulates pieces of the liver, making nodules. And so you have that nodular liver.
That doesn't sound good, but how does it affect your health?
So many times the earlier stages of fibrosis can be asymptomatic, but ultimately when you have cirrhosis, the capacity of the liver to perform its function starts to go down and it becomes a plumbing issue. Earlier on, we talked about how the gut drains into the portal circulation and then trickles through the liver. What happens is when that liver is so cirrhotic, the architecture is completely in disarray. The blood can't get through anymore. So that portal circulation, the blood can't get through. It's pushing, and you ultimately develop something called portal hypertension or high pressure in that portal circulation. And that manifests as opening up channels that weren't previously there. So again, if it's plumbing, so normally veins drain into that portal vein. If the blood now cannot get through, it backs up and you develop esophageal varices that can bleed under pressure. So those veins are already always there, but they're just not under pressure. As that pressure develops, you develop esophageal varices and you can bleed from them when patients, can come in vomiting blood. The spleen also drains into that circulation. And so the spleen gets bigger and bigger because, again, the blood can't get through. As the spleen gets bigger and bigger, it starts to trap platelets. So patients with advanced liver disease will have low platelets. They'll have the risk of esophageal variceal bleeding. And you'll also develop ascites. So when you see patients, in pictures where they look like they're pregnant, but they're, a 70-year-old man, that's fluid. Again, it's a plumbing problem. So cirrhosis ends up causing issues from the plumbing problem. But then those liver cells can't make important proteins that we need, such as albumin and such as clotting factors. So when your liver can't make clotting factors, you have a predisposition to bleeding as well. And that's manifested by an increased INR or bleeding time. And so when we look at patients for liver transplantation, there's a MELD system, and that MELD system takes into account kind of that worsening function of the liver.
It sounds like it can be actually quite devastating by the time you get to this situation where the liver is really not doing its job at all.
Correct.
How do you take care of that situation? How is it treated?
So first and foremost, you're trying to treat the etiologic problem, right? So if you're developing fibrosis from alcohol, if you stop the fibrosis, it will resolve. if the fibrosis is developing because of increased fat in the liver, if you decrease fat in the liver, it will resolve. If you have hepatitis C and you cure your hepatitis C, the fibrosis will resolve. The cirrhosis happens when we haven't effectively dealt with the etiologic agent. And then we're really dealing with the symptoms and trying to decrease the chance of having a variceal bleed, decrease the chance of developing ascites. And we do that through medications to try to decrease the pressure in that portal circulation. We can do that by endoscopically putting rubber bands on those varices to stimulate a fibrotic response and decreasing their risk of bleeding. So then we're managing symptoms. And ultimately, that's when you're talking liver transplantation and the liver failure. The liver is now failing, and the only way to solve the problem is through liver transplantation. But hopefully, you know, we want people to deal with it before we get to that point. And many of the diseases now have treatments that can prevent that progression to cirrhosis in the first place.
Dr. Bonsall, a lot of our listeners want to know how to prevent problems. And so, obviously, alcoholism is a major cause of liver cirrhosis. And so, you know, cut back or eliminate alcohol like my Uncle Gene did would be a good idea. But what are some of the other preventive strategies in order to prevent liver disease in the first place? And in particular, now that you've mentioned, you know, what we used to call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and has a new name, what can we do to prevent that from happening besides not overeating and perhaps cutting back on things like fructose?
So let me just quickly talk about why the name was changed. So the name non-alcoholic fatty liver disease was really kind of coined back in 1980 by a pathologist, Ludwig, when on liver biopsy, he's seeing fat or steatosis associated with inflammation, fibrosis, and it looks very similar to alcohol-associated steatohepatitis, but the patients like your Uncle Gene were teetotalers. So that's how it got coined, non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. So the nomenclature change does a couple of things. One, it recognizes the fact that metabolic dysfunction is an underpinning to the disease pathophysiology. What is metabolic dysfunction? That's insulin resistance, prediabetes, that visceral adiposity that I talked about. So the nomenclature change, one, is achieving, let's call it what it is, not what it is not. And two, can we remove stigma from the name, getting rid of alcohol entirely and getting rid of the term fatty, which again may not be stigmatizing to some, but the goal should be to try to have as non-stigmatizing language at all. So now metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis is calling it what it is and eliminating as much possible stigma. You know, it's a consensus, right? Not everybody's going to agree, but we have to come to some consensus. Now, how do you prevent that? How do you...
That's what we want to know. Yes.
Yes. So how do you prevent that? One, having a healthy body weight. That is absolutely critical. So BMI is one thing, you know, BMI less than 25, 23, if you're of Asian descent. But also focusing on that belly fat, right? So I said apple versus pear. So working on abdominal fat through exercise and dietary interventions. We recommend a coffee. Black coffee, 2 to 3 cups a day, has been shown to decrease liver fibrosis. So that is a standard recommendation for us to our patients. We recommend weight training. So in terms of what exercise to do, you want to exercise at moderate intensity, at least 150 minutes per week. associated with resistance training 2 to 3 times a week because the muscles are very important in how we handle glucose and fat. And also, as we get older, we lose muscle mass, and low muscle mass is associated with poor outcomes if you have liver disease.
Dr. Mina Bonsall, thank you very much for talking with us on the People's Pharmacy this week.
It was really my pleasure, and I thank you guys for inviting me to join you.
You've been listening to Dr. Mina Bonsall, Professor of Medicine at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. She is System Chief of the Division of Liver Diseases and Director of the MASH-NASH Center of Excellence at Mount Sinai.
We turn now to Dr. Jawad Ahmad. He is a professor of liver diseases at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He is co-primary investigator on the NIH-NIDDK research initiative to study cases of severe liver injury caused by prescription drugs, OTC medications, and alternative medicines.
Welcome to the People's Pharmacy, Dr. Jawad Ahmad.
Thanks for inviting me.
Dr. Ahmad, I think Americans kind of take our livers for granted. You know, we've been told that other populations are more interested in liver function. The French, for example, worry a lot about their livers. But here we just seem to take it for granted. We don't worry about the medications we take. In fact, we take a lot of drugs, especially over the counter. You are an expert in drug-induced liver disease. Can we start with acetaminophen, Tylenol, a drug that literally millions of people take every day without thinking twice? They probably imagine it to be the safest medicine in the pharmacy. What are the problems of taking too much acetaminophen too often for the liver?
So acetaminophen, as you said, is readily available. You can go to your local drugstore or Costco and literally get 1,000 pills. It's an effective drug for minor aches and pains. The problem with acetaminophen is that it's toxic to your liver if you take too much of it. And too much, what is too much? So for a normal person, they can take 3 to 4 grams of Tylenol in a 24-hour period. So if they're 500 milligram pills, you can take 6 or 8 pills in a 24-hour period. The problem becomes when you take more than that. It overcomes the liver's ability to break it down. And what happens is that it becomes toxic to you. So unfortunately, because you can buy it in quantities of hundreds, this is a common reason people are seen in the intensive care unit or in the emergency room having taken an overdose of acetaminophen.
I am assuming that not all of these people who have overdosed realized that they were taking too much acetaminophen. It's available in a lot of different forms.
Yes, so that's a common reason we see patients as well, is that people are unaware that, you know, your cough remedy like NyQuil or DayQuil will have acetaminophen in it. And so if you're taking, you know, you have the flu, you've got a headache, you take some Tylenol, and then in addition you're taking DayQuil or NyQuil, then you're taking more than you actually thought. So sometimes we see patients who have an overdose of acetaminophen, which we call a therapeutic misadventure. They were unaware that there was Tylenol in various things they were taking, and so they end up taking more than they should. Whereas also we see patients who intentionally take an overdose.
Now, I assume some people are more susceptible to acetaminophen, or as it's called in Europe, Panadol, where they might be vulnerable if they were taking, let's just say, 2,500 milligrams, but taking it not just for a few days, but for weeks or months because they have, let's say, regular headaches or maybe even arthritis pain.
Yeah, so that's an important point. When we advise patients that, you know, acetaminophen is okay to take and you can take, you know, 6 or 8 pills in a day, that's assuming that your liver is working normally. If your liver is not working normally, and unfortunately, sometimes you can have significant problems with your liver and not know about it. It's not like when you have heart disease or lung disease where you have symptoms. Oftentimes, you can have liver disease and not really know about it. But if your liver is not working optimally and you take even, you know, 4 or 5 pills of Tylenol, that can lead to a situation where it's toxic to you. Similarly, as you mentioned, some people take Tylenol on a chronic basis, meaning for weeks and weeks and weeks. Those patients also, you need to be a little bit careful because there is some suggestion that the cumulative dose can lead to an increased risk of injury.
Now, there is an antidote to acetaminophen toxicity.
Yes.
Tylenol. And we even knew a pharmacologist at Duke who had suggested that the manufacturers should put that antidote in with the pill because it's relatively safe and it would prevent the kinds of toxicity to the liver that we've been talking about. What is the antidote and what are your thoughts about including it along with acetaminophen?
So that's very interesting. I've not heard of that, but the antidote we use is something called N-acetylcysteine. Essentially, the mechanism of how acetaminophen causes toxicity is that it builds up toxic metabolites if you take too much of it. And you can give a substance to kind of mop up those metabolites. So this is N-acetylcysteine, or it contains glutathione. So that's an interesting suggestion that, yeah, if you're going to give, you know, hundreds of pills of Tylenol, maybe if you added some glutathione to the pills to try and counteract any effect of overdose, that's actually not an unreasonable suggestion, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's abbreviated NAC, NAC, and a lot of people are actually taking NAC as a dietary supplement for some other benefits. So, yeah, if people have been taking a high dose for a long period of time, it might not be such a bad idea to add NAC.
Yes, actually, that's not a bad idea. I mean, it doesn't really have any kind of adverse effects. And then we use it for patients who come into the hospital who may or may not had an injury from Tylenol, but we suspect it because their liver tests, their liver biochemical tests are very elevated. And so we use that in that situation as a kind of an antidote in case the patient has acetaminophen toxicity.
Is that the primary way that you would assess whether or not someone's liver is working normally or is under strain?
So yes, blood tests are usually the easiest way of doing it. There are some other ways of doing it which are more specialized. But essentially, when we see a patient in the office, when I want to assess their liver function, I will do blood tests of their liver. And sometimes I'll do a scan, like an ultrasound or a CAT scan or an MRI, to get some idea of what the liver looks like and what some of the other organs and blood vessels around the liver look like.
Dr. Ahmad, how would somebody know if their liver was starting to develop toxicity? They may not be going in for a regular blood test. Are there any signs or symptoms that should alert them to trouble?
No, that's why this is difficult. Oftentimes, the symptoms, there may not be any, but sometimes patients will just not feel well. Non-specific things like nausea, some mild abdominal pain, sometimes some vomiting, fatigue, malaise. But If you've taken a lot of Tylenol, the way to figure out if there's a problem would be to get blood tests done.
You're listening to Dr. Jawad Ahmad, professor of liver diseases at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine.
It's time for a short break. When we come back, we'll learn about other pain relievers that may affect the liver.
Do NSAIDs have the potential to harm it?
There are antibiotics, corticosteroids, and statins as well that can be problematic.
Natural products may also tax the liver. Which ones worry Dr. Ahmad the most?
Learn how to avoid liver damage.
You're listening to The People's Pharmacy with Joe and Terry Graydon.
Thank you. Welcome back to The People's Pharmacy. I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Your liver is responsible for processing medicines as well as nutrients before sending them on to the rest of the body. We've been talking about acetaminophen, but that's not the only medication that can challenge the liver. Some antibiotics and other pain relievers can also cause mischief.
We often take dietary supplements for granted, assuming they're completely safe. There are some, however, that can pose problems for the liver. To find out more about this concern, we continue our conversation with Dr. Jawad Ahmad, professor of liver diseases at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He is co-primary investigator on the NIH-NIDDK research initiative to study cases of severe liver injury caused by prescription drugs, over-the-counter medications, and alternative treatments such as herbal products and supplements.
Dr. Ahmad, acetaminophen is not the only pain reliever that people may use, even chronically. Are there others that also have an impact on the liver?
Yes. You have to remember, pretty much everything that you take, any medication, is metabolized by your liver. So everything that you take potentially can have an injury to your liver. So when we talk about painkillers, again, there are many other painkillers that are available over the counter, such as the a class of drugs called non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. So this will be things like ibuprofen, naproxen. These drugs are actually a little bit safer in terms of liver injury. When we were talking about acetaminophen previously, that's a very well-known toxin if you take it in overdose. The problem with NSAIDs as a class is that they can cause liver injury. It's usually much less frequent, but it's not predictable. It's what we will call idiosyncratic liver injury, where for no rhyme or reason, somebody takes it and it can cause a liver injury, sometimes very similar to Tylenol. But that may, and it may not be in overdose either.
What about some other medications? There are antibiotics, for example, a whole class called fluoroquinolones. So Levaquin would be a classic example. And what about some others like azithromycin? We call them macrolides. These are drugs that are prescribed quite frequently, but fortunately not for long periods of time. And then there is a corticosteroid called methylprednisolone that you have studied. Help us understand other medications that might be problematic.
So I'm glad you brought up these examples. I was part of a national study called the Drug-Induced Liver Injury Network, where we collected cases of drug-induced liver injury amongst the population. And if you look at the types of drugs that cause liver injury, the commonest class of drugs were antibiotics. So antimicrobials, as you mentioned, Zithromax. But the classic ones are things like Augmentin or Bactrin, things that are given for a urinary tract infection or a chest infection, usually for a 5 to 7 day course. All of these drugs potentially can cause a liver injury. And the important thing to remember is that it's idiosyncratic. You cannot predict this. Fortunately, it doesn't happen very frequently. It's not like, 5% of the population are going to get an injury. It's much, much less than that. The other things that can cause an injury, you mentioned fluoroquinolones, methylprednisolone, pretty much every drug that's prescribed can cause a liver injury. Methylprednisolone is an interesting one in that it's a steroid which is sometimes given, steroid drugs are sometimes given in patients with liver injury to reduce the inflammation. So it's strange that a drug that is used for inflammation of the liver can cause an injury as well. So this is something that we had studied. The fluoroquinolones are a class of drug that are also handed out very frequently for many infections. But again, the risk of a liver injury, and it's important to remember it, is still very low. In the order of one in every few thousand prescriptions is going to cause an injury. But when you have drugs that are given out so frequently, this is why we see many examples of this.
Let me ask you about a category of medications that is very popular. A lot of people are taking statins to control their cholesterol. And one of the things that we would hear when statins were first introduced, we rarely hear it anymore, is you have to go in for tests of your liver enzymes every so often. Do statins cause liver injury?
Yes, as I mentioned, so any drug can cause a liver injury. With statins, this is in the first few months that you're on a statin, because remember, a statin is a drug that's given indefinitely to keep your cholesterol under control, it can cause a mild elevation of your liver tests, which is usually something that will get better over time. But the recommendation is that when you first start it is to check every so often, just in case the liver enzymes continue to rise, and then you would need to stop. But you have to remember, statins are given to millions of people, and it's a very infrequent cause of liver injury. So it's a very safe drug. And remember, you're giving it for a very good reason. Having high cholesterol that's untreated, it leads to many adverse cardiovascular events. So yes, statins can cause a liver injury, but the risk is very, very small. And as long as you get your liver test checked for the first few months, and if they're normal and your doctor is happy with the way the cholesterol is being controlled, that they're a very safe drug to take.
Dr. Ahmad, I wonder if you would share with us the drugs that worry you most in terms of liver injury, or perhaps it's herbs.
So that's a very good segue, actually, that I mentioned earlier that the drug-induced liver injury collects cases of liver injury from prescription medicines, but they also collect injury from herbal and dietary supplements. So these are taken by, I would say, two-thirds of the population takes something, a supplement, a vitamin, something just to make you feel better. I worry the most about that class of drugs, in the sense that these are not classified by the government as drugs. They're classified as supplements. Why is that important? That's important because the regulation is very different. A drug company makes a drug. That drug is tested. You need to know exactly how much is in there, what else is in the compound that you're putting in your body. Herbal and dietary supplements are not checked in the same way. So it's very easy for someone to say, well, you can take so-and-so because this is good for your liver or good for your kidney or good for your overall health. And then there are no studies that have been done to prove that. And there is no real regulation in terms of what is involved in making that compound and what are the ingredients of that compound. So I worry the most about herbal and dietary supplement liver injury.
Have you seen any specific supplements that have resulted in trouble?
Absolutely. Some very famous examples. We've looked at this ourselves. Green tea extract. So green tea extract is thought to be a useful way to lose weight. It's included in many fat burners. And we published a study a few years ago showing that we had 40 cases amongst several hundred of liver injury, pretty severe liver injury, from people who had taken compounds that contain green tea extract. Similarly, turmeric is something that's kind of in vogue these days as a kind of a general health thing to take. We've seen liver injury from turmeric. We've seen it from something called kratom, which is used oftentimes, unfortunately, by people who are addicted to opiates. Something that you can buy over the counter that can kind of mimic the effect. We've seen liver injury from kratom. But pretty much any compound, ashwagandha is another good example, that you can take. Unfortunately, because it's not regulated, it's very difficult for us to prove that this is what caused the injury, because a lot of these compounds have multiple ingredients. So this is something that, again, we've studied that shows that more than half the time, what's written on the label of whatever compound you're taking, whatever herbal and dietary supplement you're taking, the label is incorrect. It may say it contains this and this and this, but oftentimes it will not contain that, and it will contain other things that are not written on the label. So you can imagine that that's a situation where liver injury can be occurring, but it's very difficult to figure out which of the ingredients of the compound caused it.
And part of that is due to the way that United States actually regulates or almost doesn't regulate its dietary supplements. I'm assuming, and I need to check with you to make sure my assumption is correct, that if you drink green tea, if you eat curry made with turmeric, that you're not putting your liver at risk.
No, absolutely. So this is an important point. When we talk about green tea extract, when we talk about turmeric, if you're drinking green tea, you're using your green tea bag or your filter tea, the green tea extract is concentrated. Again, unfortunately, this is the way we think, right? That we think, oh, if the green tea is good for me, I should take much more of it. So if I take an extract with 100 times as much, maybe that would be better for me. So the injury that we see is not from drinking green tea. It's from very concentrated green tea, which is the green tea extract. Or similarly with turmeric, when you add it to your curry, you use like half a teaspoon or a teaspoon. We're talking about when you're taking it in a tablet, it's a concentrated form. So you're taking oftentimes, 10, 50, 100 times more than you would be when you were drinking the green tea or using turmeric in your curry.
Is there any way to compare the risk? And you've pointed out, for example, that acetaminophen is very high on your list of pharmaceuticals that can be problematic if you take a high dose for a long period of time, compared to, for example, let's say a statin that is a relatively low dose and has a very low risk, compared to a dietary supplement, for example, like turmeric. Is there any way so that our listeners could get a sense of acetaminophen versus turmeric? Because they're both often used for pain, especially pain of arthritis. How risky would it be? And if somebody showed up in your hospital with liver damage as a result of either a drug or an herb, like ashwagandha, for example, or green tea extract, what would you do? How would you treat them?
So you asked several questions there. So I want to make sure the audience understands. Acetaminophen is a very predictable cause of liver injury if you take an overdose. It's very safe as long as you take only 4 or 5 pills in a 24-hour period. It's a very safe drug. In fact, it's a drug that I would use in patients with liver disease, even though people worry about it. That's very different from the other drugs that we and herbal and dietary supplements that we've been talking about, where we talk about idiosyncratic. So this is for no rhyme or reason someone gets an injury. Those drugs are much less likely than acetaminophen to cause an injury because it occurs maybe in 1 in 1,000 or 1 in 5,000 people. So if people ask, what are that I worry about the most, acetaminophen I worry about most because I know it will cause a liver injury if you take too much. The other drugs, you mentioned statins, right? So one of the problems when you study drug-induced liver injury is that you need to know your denominator, the population that was at risk. Obviously, we see an injury in an individual, but how many individuals took the drug and didn't have an injury, right? So you need to know the denominator. So there is some data on this, and there are some drugs that are much more likely to cause a liver injury versus some other drugs. Statins, as you mentioned, they're actually very, very safe. A lot of people have to take a statin for one person to have a liver injury. But this is an area that's evolving, and when we talk about research, to try and figure out, okay, well, how likely is someone to get an injury from a prescription drug? With prescription drugs, we have data on how many prescriptions are given out in a year. The problem with studying herbal and dietary supplements is that we have a rough idea of how many people take these, but we really don't have a very good idea. Your second question was about how do we treat these people? So if I have someone who comes to the hospital, it depends on the severity of the liver injury. If you come to the hospital, it supposes that you have a severe injury, right? That you had symptoms, or your doctor said you need to go to the emergency room, or you're jaundiced, right? So this is one thing that we worry about. If you have a liver injury from a medicine or a drug, and you're jaundiced, meaning your eyes look yellow, or if you have light skin, your skin looks yellow, that's a very dangerous sign. That is associated with a risk of death. So those patients, if we saw in the hospital, we would monitor them. And unfortunately, some of those patients we would think about, if their liver injury is not improving, are they patients that need to undergo liver transplantation?
Dr. Ahmad, are there any antidotes to liver toxicity? We hear a lot about an herb called milk thistle, which is supposed to be good for the liver. Does that work at all?
Milk thistle is an interesting compound. I wouldn't consider it an antidote. Milk thistle became popular, I would say, 20, 25 years ago, when we still had problems with liver disease from hepatitis C. So hepatitis C is a virus that causes liver injury that we had a very difficult time treating until we developed a class of drugs that have essentially made hepatitis C almost disappear in terms of patients developing bad liver injury. So milk thistle is a supplement, which in some studies showed that in people with hepatitis C, who otherwise could not get treated before we had good treatment, showed some improvement in their liver function in terms of how bad their liver disease was. It's not really an antidote for someone who has an acute injury, something that just happened from an herbal and dietary supplement.
Dr. Ahmad, we have talked about acetaminophen. We've talked about pain relievers like non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. We've talked a little bit about statins. I'm curious about antifungal drugs, drugs such as ketoconazole, fluconazole. These are medications that are actually prescribed fairly frequently for something that's fairly benign, toenail fungus, kind of an infection of the toenails. But people also get fungal infections throughout their body. How dangerous are these antifungals for the liver?
So that's also a very interesting point. Antifungals, I would describe as a little bit more risky in terms of liver injury than the regular antimicrobials, because antimicrobials like augmentin, Bactrin, they're given out much more frequently. So we had talked about this a little earlier. What's the risk of this injury in terms of how often it's prescribed? I think the important thing to remember, if you're using antifungals, if it's in the form of a cream, they're very safe because the amount that you absorb into your body. So if you have a toenail fungus and you're given an antifungal cream to apply, that's very safe. If someone's giving you oral antifungal, so a pill that you have, that you're taking, you should have your liver test monitored while you're on that drug. Oftentimes it's only for a week, that's okay. But if sometimes you're having a prolonged course, then you should be monitored. The people who get those types of injuries, though, if you have like a disseminated fungal infection, those people are usually very, very sick or in the hospital. So the topical antifungals should not be a problem. If you have to take an oral course of antifungals, yes, as we mentioned before with the statins, you should get your liver enzymes checked before you take it and while you're on it.
Dr. Jawad Ahmad, thank you very much for talking with us on The People's Pharmacy today.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Dr. Jawad Ahmad, professor of liver diseases at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. He is co-primary investigator on the NIH-NIDDK research initiative to study cases of severe liver injury caused by prescription drugs, over-the-counter medications, and alternative medicines such as herbal products and supplements.
Lynn Siegel produced today's show. Al Wodarski engineered. Dave Graydon edits our interviews. B.J. Lederman composed our theme music.
This show is a co-production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, with the People's Pharmacy.
Today's show is number 1,429. You can find it online at peoplespharmacy.com. That's where you can share your comments about today's interview. You can also reach us through email, radio@peoplespharmacy.com.
Our interviews are available through your favorite podcast provider. You'll find the podcast on our website on Monday morning. On this week's podcast, you'll get more information on the benefits of black coffee and what types of diet support the liver best. Should Americans become more like the French who are concerned about their liver health? You'll also find out which diseases are especially bad for your liver.
At peoplespharmacy.com, you can sign up for our free online newsletter to get the latest news about important health stories. When you subscribe, you also have regular access to information about our weekly podcast, so you can find out ahead of time what topics we'll be covering. Speaking of the podcast, we would be so grateful if you would consider writing a review of The People's Pharmacy and posting it to the podcast platform you prefer. In Durham, North Carolina, I'm Joe Graydon.
And I'm Terry Graydon. Thank you for listening. Please join us again next week.